Radha Madhava Kunj Bihari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunj Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Janarandana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Janarandana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunj Bihari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunj Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Janarandana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Janarandana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunj Bihari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunj Bihari. Jaya Om Vishnupada Paramahansa Parivrajaka Acharya Stuttara Sutta Shri Shimad Hishtavayanga Isaisi Bhakti Vairanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Kantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Nitai Gau Premanande Hari Hari Bo Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Agavish the Assembled Devotees Agavish the Assembled Devotees Agavish the Assembled Devotees Agarishya Shri Shri Guru Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 21, conversation between Manu and Kardama. Text number 25. Word meanings. Prajapati Sutta, the son of Lord Brahma, Samrat, the emperor, Manu, Swayambhuva Manu, Vikyata, well-known, Mangalaha, whose righteous acts, Brahmavartam, Brahmavarta, Yah, he who, Adhivasan, living in, Shasti, rules, Supta, seven, Arnavam, oceans, Mahim, the earth. Prajapati Suti Samran Manurvikyata Mangala Brahmavartam Yodhivasan Shasti Saptarnavam Mahim Prajapati Sutta Samran Manurvikyata Mangala Brahmavartam Yodhivasan Shasti Saptarnavamahim Prajapati Sutta Samran Manurvikyata Mangala Brahmavartam Yodhivasan Shasti Saptarnavamahim Prajapati Sutta Samran Manurvikyata Mangala Brahmavartam Yodhivasan Jati Saptar Navamahim. Prajapati Sutta Samran Manurvikyatam Brahmavartam Yodhivasan Shasti Saptarnavamahim Prajapati Sutta Samran Manurvikyata Mangala Brahmavartam Yodhivasan Shasti Saptarnavamahim. Translation. The Emperor Swayambhuva Manu, the son of Lord Brahma, who is well known for his righteous acts, has his seat in Brahmavarta and rules over the earth with its seven oceans. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Sometimes it is stated that Brahmavarta is a part of Kurukshetra, or that Kurukshetra itself is situated in Brahmavarta, because the demigods are recommended to perform spiritual ritualistic performances in Kurukshetra. But in others' opinion, Brahmavarta is a place in Brahmaloka, where Swayambhuva Manu ruled. There are many places on the surface of this earth which are also known in the higher planetary systems. We have places on this planet like Vrindavan, Dwaraka, and Mathura, but they are also eternally situated in Krishna Loka. There are many similar names on the surface of the earth, and it may be that in the Bohr age, Swayambhuva Manu ruled this planet, as stated here. The word Mangala is significant. Mangala means one who is elevated in every respect, in the opulences of religious performances, ruling power, cleanliness, and all other good qualities. Vikyata means celebrated. Swayambhuva Manu was celebrated for all good qualities and opulences. Om Jnanati Mirantasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Milita Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Somewhat an unusual purport today. I can't figure it out. So class dismissed. No. So Prabhupada, it's interesting actually that first Prabhupada explains how there's different opinions on what this Brahmavarta is. First of all, the context, of course, Lord Vishnu has come to see Kardama Muni because Kardama Muni has been performing, well, he's a Prajapati, so his service is to produce population. And so Lord Vishnu has arrived. Shukla, the particular form of Lord Vishnu is called Shukla, white, for some reason. And he's telling him, of course, he's going to tell him that Swayambhuva Manu is coming to give his daughter to him. So he's introducing Swayambhuva Manu. So that's what this is, a little something about Swayambhuva Manu. So it said in the verse that he rules Brahmavarta. And apparently no one's quite sure what this Brahmavarta is exactly. I always thought it was the same thing as Aryavarta, but trying to figure this out, it seems like they're not exactly the same thing. Aryavarta is, of course, where the Aryans live. Manu is, of course, in that category, one who is interested in perfecting one's life and has all good qualities, like it says here about him. So that's always described as the area, it's North India, basically. Sometimes it says it's the area between the Ganga and Yamuna, the area of North India between Ganga and Yamuna. And sometimes it says it's from the Himalayas to the Vindhya Hills, which are sort of like north central India. So somehow it's in North India. That's called Aryavarta. Now this Brahmavarta also seems to be, as Prabhupada says, some say that it's part of Kurukshetra, or Kurukshetra is in Brahmavarta, which is interesting. Now what is, I found another reference to it. Let's see what it says. Hare Krishna. Oh, here, this is from, the next chapter. The city of Barhishmati. Oh, this is about, well, so this is where the main city, the city of Barhishmati. So that's actually where he rules from, where Manu, where he lives in this particular city. If Brahmavarta is a region, then the capital of that region, or state, or country, as Desha, maybe it's called. So this is from the next chapter. It says, the city of Barhishmati, where Swayambhuva Manu and his wife and retinue went after this whole episode takes place. The city of Barhishmati, rich in all kinds of wealth, was so called because Lord Vishnu's hair dropped there from his body when he manifested himself as Lord Boar. Now, as Prabhupada sometimes does, he says it's called something, but then he doesn't quite explain why it would be called Barhishmati, because some hair went there. The word Barhi, actually, it means a couple of things. It means peacocks, for one, and then it also means, Barhi is kusha grass. So we can see, maybe there's a connection. One thing about Lord Boar, he's always described as sacrificial performances personified. When he's being offered prayers earlier in the third canto, we read about his incarnation, then so many verses have to do with him as sacrifice. This part of his body is this part of the sacrifice, and this part of the body is another part of the sacrifice. So Barhi would make sense relating it to Lord Boar. If that's why, Prabhupada doesn't explain it, but that could be a reason why it's called Barhishmati, because of the Barhi. Just like we have Prachina Barhi, that's a king. Actually, Prachin means the old or former old king Barhi, which means he also, of course, we know Prachina Barhishat, Narada Muni instructs him the Paranjana section story of the Bhagavatam, spoken by Narada Muni, is to convince this King Prachina Bhartishat to give up karmakanda activities and take the pure devotional service. So he has also his Bharti in his name because he's performing so many sacrifices. One interesting thing about it is often also the mat that one sits on is also called Bharti because it's made of kusha grass generally. And we often hear it has to be done in a particular way. The roots of the Bharti grass face the east and the performer faces the north. Sits on the mat whose roots are facing east and the performer faces north to perform the yajna. So that's that. But then we have this other. It says some people think that it could be Brahmaloka that's being referred to. Brahmavarta is a place in Brahmaloka where Swayambhuva ruled. So it's often hard to figure out in the Bhagavatam where things are taking place. Now Sataputta Prabhu, he made a comment on this in the context of talking about, I don't remember if it was Prapti City, but he does sometimes talk about Prapti City, where the yogis can take something from one place. Like Prabhupada would give the example that it was, I think it was some yogi that his family knew, his father knew. His guru one time said, you know, what would you like to eat? He said, like a pomegranate from Kabul. You know, story. So somehow or other, he said, go in the other room. So on the table in the other room was a fresh pomegranate from Kabul all the way across India. So Sariputta would say, it doesn't seem like he could somehow stretch his hand all the way from Bengal to Kabul, Afghanistan, and bring it back. So he said, there must be some subtle connection between places that with mystic power you can cross the distance and go there and acquire things and so on. So Sariputta Prabhu, I think it was in that context where he was talking about it. And he said, that's maybe what's being referred to here. Brahmavarta is a place in Brahmaloka, that there is a corresponding place on earth where you can access Brahmaloka quickly. So, of course, in Prabhupada, in this context, he also talks about, we have places, what does he say here? There are many places on the surface of the earth which are known in higher planetary systems. So that doesn't seem to be saying so much. People up there, they know about different places on the earth. Okay. Now that what seems to be implied here, though, is because they're special places, sacrifices are taking place. Now, Prabhupada specifically mentions Vrindavan, Dwarka, and Mathura, which are here, but are also eternally situated in Krishna Loka. So that's a kind of different kind of thing, really. The Dham exists in the spiritual world, and the Dham exists here in the material world, and there's no difference between the two, really. So it's sort of like Prabhupada is taking some stabs at different ideas related to this. Then he says here, there are many similar names on the surface of the earth. I'm not sure what he means by that. There are many similar names on the surface of the earth. I thought he meant, just like there's a Mathura here and the Mathura in the spiritual world, then there are, in the higher planets, there are other kinds of cities like Kanpur or Madras or whatever, that's also existing. He said, there are many similar names on the surface of the earth. Similar in what respect? And it seems like he's saying, it may be that in the age of the Boar Age, Swayambhuva Manu ruled this planet, as stated here. So that's the general understanding, is that yes, Swayambhuva Manu did rule this planet in the earlier age. So I won't say a little something about Swayambhuva Manu and also the age of the time that we're in, review somewhat how this time works. We're right now here, he says here, he does mention the boar. Well, he mentions the boar, in this other verse that I read. So he's ruling. Swayambhuva Manu is the first of the 14 Manus in the day of Brahma. And right now, of course, he's one of the Mahajans also, listed by Yamaraj in the sixth canto, the 12 Mahajans. So one of them is Manu, and that's usually taken to mean Swayambhuva Manu. So he's the first Manu. There's 14 Manus in the day of Brahma. And we get some of this information from the Bhagavatam and other, it seems like it's from other Puranas. But it's considered that, so he's the first Manvantara in the day of Brahma. So a day, so Brahma, of course, he has lots of days. Brahma's time is broken up into months and not weeks. He has 30 days in a month, not 7 days in a week. They don't talk about weeks on this level. It talks about months. So there are 30 days. Each one of those is called a kalpa. Prabhupada would often use the word millennium, although I think he used the word millennium to mean other things as well. But often when he would use the word millennium, he was talking about a kalpa or a day of Brahma. So again, Brahma has 30 days. So right now it's said that he's in the very beginning of his 51st year. I pointed out how actually in my last class, that Brahma's time, his lifespan is called Dwiparartha, which means two half paras. For some reason it's stated like that. Instead of saying one para, it's called two half paras, P-A-R-A. So Dwiparartha. So anyway, the first half of his life is finished. So apparently that's a milestone when he begins the second half of his life. And we're at just the beginning of Brahma's second half of his life, and it's also the first day of that second half. So Swayambhuva Manu is beginning right at the beginning of that first day of the second half of Brahma's life, the first day, the first month, or the first year of the second half of his life. So Swayambhuva Manu comes first. Now, of course, Swayambhuva Manu, because there are 14 Manus in a day of Brahma, each Manu rules for 71 plus a little over 71. I'm not sure why it's not an even number, but it doesn't come out even. I don't know why. It seems like he changes his rule in the middle of one of these Chaturyugas. So there's 71 Chaturyugas, 71 plus Chaturyugas that each Manu rules. So Swayambhuva Manu comes first. And now it's interesting because the different ways of looking at time, we often think about, for example, in a very limited way, we talk about, was that in Treta Yuga or Satya Yuga? Well, there's lots of Satya Yugas. There's 1,000 Satya Yugas in just one day of Brahma. And there's 71 of them in Swayambhuva Manu's rule, just one Manu. And now we're on the seventh, I forget. Vaivasvata Manu. Now we're in the reign of Vaivasvata Manu. So many Manus have passed with their 71 Chaturyugas each since Swayambhuva Manu was here. And each one of those lasts a very long time. And they have... So each Manu has 71 Chaturyugas. So right now we're in the 28th Chaturyuga of Vaivasvata Manu. So you start thinking of these time spans. They're so immense. So again, we tend to focus. For example, most of the Bhagavatam, well, a lot of it takes place in Vaivasvata Manu, but not all of it. Actually, a lot of it, the first part, pretty much up all the way through at least to the fourth, well, actually up to the eighth canto, at the beginning of the eighth canto, I forget who the questioner is at that point. Maybe Parikshit Maharaj asking Shukadev Goswami. He said, you've talked about Swayambhuva Manu. Can you talk about other Manus? So all the way up to that point, pretty much the context is Swayambhuva Manu's reign. And then we hear what happens is Shukadev or whoever's speaking, I think it's Shukadev, when he gets to different Manus, then he said something about them. Like he'll say, in this Manvantara, Lord Varaha appeared. Of course, Lord Varaha appeared in Swayambhuva. But then he'll say, Vamanadeva appeared or someone else appeared. And then we'll hear the story of this particular avatar in the context of the list of the different Manvantaras, the rulers of those different Manvantaras. And of course, each Manvantara, each Manu in his period, there's a specific incarnation, just like we're all familiar with Yuga avatars. But we hear the word Manvantara avatar. Well, there's a Manvantara avatar too. The current one is Lord Vamanadeva. So each one of these, those are listed. There's a whole list. It's right at the beginning of the eighth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first chapter. there is a list of the different all the different manus and different avatars for those manus and other things about those different manvantars. So now we're on Swayambhuva Manu. There's information about him, some of which we've heard already, some we'll hear before. One thing is that Swayambhuva Manu, now we're going to hear, he's bringing his daughter to marry Kardama. Now who's Kardama? Kardama is listed in the beginning of the, going back in the, a lot of the context of the Bhagavatam is about creation, how it unfolds. So in Vidura, Maitreya is speaking to Vidura, what he does at the beginning, as many speakers do, he starts talking about the creation. So he talks about creation. Well, the 12th chapter is called Creation of the Kumaras and Others, after he's already talked about some other aspects of the creation. So the Kumaras are created, Lord Shiva is created, and then the first Prajapatis and sages are created. And, of course, we have this painting in the Bhagavatam that someone comes from his mind and someone comes from his ear and someone, you know, these different places. So after that list of those first nine, the tenth is Narad Muni, actually. He's in a different category from the other ones. He's not a Prajapati. So after that list, for some reason, Kardama Muni is mentioned separate from them. I'm not exactly sure why. Because just like Daksha is created from the thumb of Brahma. So Kardama Muni is created from the shadow of Lord Brahma. So Kardama Muni is a direct son, just like these other original Prajapatis in the creation. Kardama Muni, he's not the grandson further down the line. He's also a direct son of Lord Brahma. So Swayambhuva Manu himself, he's also a direct son of Lord Brahma. So they're brothers in a sense. Although, now there's this interesting, when you read about it, it says that Lord Brahma wasn't satisfied that things were happening quickly enough. So he just basically manifested Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa. So because their birth is so unusual, he's not necessarily considered to be their father. This is from the 12th canto, chapter 12. Chapter 12 of the 10th canto is a summary of the Bhagavatam. It says, this was spoken of, and this was spoken of, and this was like that. So this is this one verse, 12:12-11. The Bhagavatam also describes the creation of demigods, animals, and demoniac species of life, the birth of Lord Rudra, and the appearance of Swayambhuva Manu from the half-man, half-woman Ishvara. So if you're like me, you probably never heard that before. You read it, but you didn't stick. So it says, from the half-man, half-woman Ishvara. So this seems to apply, because generally it's said that, well, we read about it in the third canto, that Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa, they came from Lord Brahma directly. So I was thinking one way to look at this is to think, well, half man, half woman, it means it didn't take a husband and a wife to create Swayambhuva Manu. Brahma did it himself. So you might say in that sense, he was acting like a half man and a half woman, and he created Swayambhuva Manu. So this is where Swayambhuva Manu came from. So Swayambhuva Manu, again, he's meant to create offspring. The whole pastime of Lord Varaha unfolds because Swayambhuva Manu says, well, what do you want us to do? And Brahma says, create population. And he said, well, we don't have any place to put them because the earth is at the bottom of the Garbhodaka ocean. So can you do something about that? So that's how the whole pastime of Lord Varaha unfolds, which is several chapters. So then we hear at some point, we hear about the children of Swayambhuva Manu. So he had five children, Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa. Uttanapad, Priyavrata, Akuti, Devahuti, and Prasuti. So King Uttanapad, I'll just mention something about each one of these. King Uttanapad, he's famous as being the father of Dhruva Maharaj. So he had two wives, Suniti and Suruchi. You know, the significance of these names, if you don't know, Niti and Ruchi. So Su means good, generally. Ruchi means taste. So she apparently was the more pretty of the two, Suruchi. More attractive, she was at least more attractive to the king. And Suniti means, Niti means conduct. So the more well-behaved of the two was Suniti. So Suruchi and Suniti. And Dhruva Maharaj, of course, was the son of Suniti. And he was offended by his stepmother, Suruchi. So all that unfolds, that whole pastime. That's actually because, this must be Vidura asking, can you tell me about the descendants of Swayambhuva Manu? So when he mentions the children, this often comes up, one child is mentioned and then a whole line is given. One thing I've noticed, there's a lot of genealogy in the Bhagavatam. And a lot of times it says, you know, this person had more than one wife often, and maybe had 10 children or something. But then you hear of the descendants of just one of them or two of them. It's not like you don't hear about all the descendants because that would be too much. So Shukadeva or Maitreya, whoever's speaking, selects certain characters. I was thinking I was reading the ninth canto, and there's really a lot of genealogy, especially in the last chapter. And I was wondering, I wonder how many characters there are in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I read thousands. There are literally must be thousands of personalities who appear. And then there are places where it says, just to hearing their names. I think this is mentioned in relation to the daughters of Daksha. It's purifying just to hear their names. So these are all, from our point of view, of course, there are forefathers and foremothers, our ancestors. So we owe them something. Right? According to Vedic culture, you owe your ancestors something. You're supposed to have children. That's how you pay them back. So there are thousands and thousands of them. So these are right from the beginning. King Uttanapad, he's a son of Swayambhuva Manu, who's quite an amazing person himself, very, very highly posted. So Dhruva Maharaj, it comes from him. And then further down the line from Dhruva Maharaj is King Prithu. So that whole story, Prithu Maharaj, which takes up like 9 chapters or something like that in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that all comes in the context of hearing about the descendants of Dhruva Maharaj and, of course, King Uttanapad. Now, one thing I find interesting is that, of course, in the story of Prithu Maharaj, we hear about his whole interaction with Mother Earth takes place and the milking of Mother Earth in so many ways. Then we hear about his descendants down the line to some point, all the way to the end of the fourth canto. We hear about the Pachetas. They must come in his line, I think. Then at the beginning of the fifth canto, Uttanapad's rule is apparently over, or even generations following him. Then we hear about Priyavrata, because Priyavrata has to be asked to rule the world. That's the way it's put, to be emperor of the world. And he's being trained by Narada Muni. He's a disciple of Narada Muni, and he just wants to remain a brahmachari. At first, he doesn't want to do it. So then at that time, Swayambhuva Manu is the one who's asking him to do it, actually. And then Lord Brahma comes. Lord Brahma descends on his swan carrier, and he talks to Priyavrata. He says, please do this. Don't worry, you won't fall into Maya. It's okay, despite what Narada Muni has told you. Narada always wants to make everybody sannyasis. So but Narada doesn't complain. Of course, his father is there, and Lord Brahma. And one thing I find interesting is that it seems like, there are a lot of things in the Bhagavatam I try to get my head around and I get lost. Uttanapad, and all this took place with Mother Earth, then Priyavrata comes next, but Priyavrata creates the 7 planets with the wheels of his chariot. So I'm thinking, well, where was Prithu doing what he was doing? So I don't know. I don't know how to reconcile those two things. So anyway, from Priyavrata. Now, one thing is, Priyavrata, and one thing that's noteworthy about him is that just a few, well, I guess it's his grandson, I think, or great-grandson, is Rishabhdev. We hear about Rishabhdev in the fifth canto. So that's because the fifth canto begins with Priyavrata. So we hear about his son and his grandson. So Lord Rishabhdev appears. And this is pointed out by the speaker, the Bhagavatam. He had the personality of Godhead as his son or grandson or whatever. So then we have Akuti. Now she married the sage Ruchi. And they also had an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. Now there's an interesting... Did I write that out here? Swayambhuva Manu, he had these two sons, Uttanapada and Priyavrata, but he wanted to have Akuti's son. He married her to Akuti on the stipulation that he would get her son to be his son. So Prabhupada says, the way it's translated, it says, here it is. This is the verse, 4.1.2, right at the beginning of the fourth canto. Akuti had two brothers, but in spite of her brothers, King Swayambhuva Manu handed her over to Prajapati Ruchi on the condition that the son born of her be returned to Manu as his son. This he did in consultation with his wife. So the idea is, when I first read this, I said, what was the idea that that maybe she should have married one of her brothers? But that's not the point here. The point is that Swayambhuva Manu already had sons. The rule was that you could take your daughter's son to be your son. If you didn't have a son and you were a king and you wanted to have someone to turn the rule over to, so you could get your grandson and make him your son, essentially. But he already had two sons, so why was he taking his daughter's son? The reason was he knew that the son was going to be an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. So that's why he made that arrangement. So his name was Yajna, or he's also called Suyajna. He's also called Yajnapati. There's a reference to him. Let's see. A couple of things. Well, one thing he did here. The Supreme Lord Vishnu, who sits in everyone's heart, appearing as Yajnapati. This is a reference to him. Oh, okay, here, yeah. He observed that the rakshasas and demons were going to devour Swayambhuva Manu. So what happens at some point, Swayambhuva Manu goes to perform austerities. First, after this we're reading about now in the third canto, he goes to his home, which is very opulent. But he's a great devotee. Still, it says that he always enjoyed his sense, I don't know if Prabhupada would use the word material opulence, something like that, in a Krishna-conscious way. So he lived in great opulence, but he was a devotee. At some point, he leaves home and he goes to perform sacrifices. And when he's doing that, he gets attacked by these demons. They wanted to devour him. Thus the Lord, accompanied by his sons, the Lord's sons, named the Yamas, and by all the other demigods, killed the demons and rakshasas. He then took the post of Indra and began to rule the heavenly kingdom. So this is what this Yajna did. He protected Swayambhuva Manu, and then he also became Indra. So he was one of the Indras. I'm not sure which this was during Swayambhuva's rule, reign or not. Sounds like it. Okay, so that's a little something about Yajna. I think he's mentioned later too, but I don't have it. So then we have Devahuti. So now we're reading about Devahuti and Kardama Muni. Now, of course, she's so important because Lord Kapiladev. So again, we have another avatar coming directly in line from Swayambhuva Manu. We have Lord Kapiladev, and we get all of Kapiladev's instructions. Those are coming up actually fairly soon. This is chapter 21. The instructions begin in chapter 25, and they go all the way through chapter 33. The end, I think, is pretty much toward the end of the third canto, rather. And then Prasuti. Now Prasuti, she's also significant, although we don't hear a name so much. We hear about Daksha, the daughters of Daksha. Now one thing also, we hear about marriages of sages and daughters, and sometimes I get these daughters mixed up. So of course Kapila, he had nine sisters, because Kardama and Devahuti, they produced nine daughters. And these nine daughters were married to these sages that I mentioned at the beginning, who were born directly from Lord Brahma. And they all had descendants. Some of their, actually there's a whole list there of their different, some of the generations coming from them. So this Prasuti, she was married to Daksha. Now Daksha, of course, he had the scandal of offending Lord Shiva at the Daksha Yajna, as it's called. So Daksha was also, he's one of the first 10, actually. And he's considered to be very expert in performing sacrifices and also creating generations. So we know what happened to Daksha, if you know the story. Of course, at the end, his head was cut off because of his offense to his daughter, Sati, and to Lord Shiva. And he got the head of a goat. And through the head of a goat, he had the darshan of Lord Vishnu, and he completed the sacrifice he had started. So then this was in the Swayambhuva Manu, Manvantara. So he appears later in the Chakshusha Manvantara, which is the fifth or sixth. So he appears again as the son of the Prachetas. The Prachetas perform sacrifice for 10,000 years. They're also supposed to produce children. So they come out from performing austerities and they start burning up the whole world, which is covered with trees. Said that they were covered with trees because there wasn't anybody to rule, to organize things and make settlements and cities and so on. So then they're persuaded to, you know, relax. They said their anger came because they performed such great austerities. So anyway, they start burning everything. But then they marry a girl who was produced by a sage and the apsara, and they produce, somehow the 10 of them produce one son, and that's Daksha. So Daksha, what was he doing in the meantime? It said that he was performing tapasya. So from Swayambhuva Manvantara all the way up to Chakshusha Manvantara, he was performing austerities to do his service, actually, and to really make up for his offense. But there was still some stain, you might say, from his offense. And the commentators, at least Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, points out that the reason Daksha curses Lord Narada Muni. Of course, Narada Muni, Daksha is producing sons. First, he produces 10,000 sons, or is it? Anyway, he produces the Haryashvas and the Savalakshvas, and then Narada Muni makes them all sannyasis, so then he decides to produce children. So he gets angry, he produces daughters, somehow he has a choice. He decides to produce 60 daughters. So he curses, or he becomes very angry, says horrible things to Narada Muni. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says this is because he offended Lord Shiva. And he described that, I came across the same idea, I think it was Lord Indra. Yeah, Lord Indra, when he got rid of the reactions to cutting off the heads of Vishwarup, he was able to get rid of the earth, water, fire, I think it's been mentioned, aspects of the curse. That's why these different, the woman, the land, and the whatever the other one is, took over the curse. Because it took her, somehow in some gross way, the offense was mitigated. But still there was a subtle aspect that's harder to get rid of. So there was a subtle aspect of Daksha, even though he had performed penances for so long, a subtle aspect of his offense remained. And that's why that caused him, you can say, to create another offense by blaspheming Narada Muni. So Daksha, anyway, that's a little something about Daksha. He plays an important role in the Bhagavatam. And he's the son of Prasuti, one of the daughters of Swayambhuva Manu. So actually I was thinking, you know, there's really no philosophy in his purport today. Not much, I guess, I could talk about the good qualities of Swayambhuva Manu. But there's a lot of genealogy. There's a lot of this kind of thing, actually. Stories connected to our ancestors in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's certainly a suitable topic in that sense, because it's there, embedded in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's part and parcel of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So a little bit of that today, reviewing some of this history of our forefathers. Well, the verse again. Prajapati Sutta Samran Manur Vikyata Mangala Brahma Bhartam Yodhivasan Shasti Saptaranavam Mahim. The Emperor Swayambhuva Manu, the son of Lord Brahma, who is well known for his righteous acts, has his seat in Brahmavarta and rules over the earth with its seven oceans. I was thinking, well, this is interesting, the seven oceans. And I went online and said, how many oceans are there? And according to our, there are five. Now they say there are five oceans. The Atlantic, Pacific, Indian, Arctic, and the Southern or Antarctic. Those are the five oceans. But it's also, some people say, actually there's only one ocean. When you get right down to it, all the planets are floating in one ocean. So there are different ways to designate these things. So the Bhagavatam uses the seven oceans. And of course, as I said earlier about Priyavrata, he created seven oceans, also different kinds of oceans. So seen from that perspective, the words, the number seven is appropriate. Okay. Much to say about that, I guess, right? Okay. Oh.
Thank you for a very nice class. I just was wondering, because some of the stories from Bhagavatam, they're from not the most current, my understanding is they're from not the most current Satya Yuga, and you know, they're from previous ones, is that correct?
Most current what?
The most current Satya Yuga or Dwarpa Yuga, they could be from previous
ones. Yeah, that sometimes happens. What the Acharyas do often is that when things seem to contradict each other, sometimes they'll say, well, this may have happened in a previous kalpa, previous day of Lord Brahma. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur often does that. He tends to explain things a lot. He does. That's one thing about our acharyas. They tend to explain a little more than Prabhupada does necessarily. Prabhupada does a lot more preaching. When you read our acharyas, they don't preach so much. They tend to explain. A lot of times they also explain the Sanskrit, what the Sanskrit means, and you know how they're translating. They don't translate exactly, but they comment on it. So they do that also. If they'll say, well, this might be. They do that. The acharyas, well, most they read Vishwanatha Chakrabarti, and Jiva Goswami also in his Siddhnarabhas quotes the Bhagavatam a lot. And they also, they make, you might say, proposals. This could be one explanation. In fact, in the Brihad Vaishnava of Toshini, which is Sanatana Goswami's commentary in the 10th canto, he does that a lot. He'll give five or six explanations, translations of the same verse of the Bhagavatam. He'll explain it, and then he'll say, or, and then he'll explain it another way, and he'll say, or, and so one of the ors is sometimes, well, maybe this happened in another kalpa.
I was wondering, since why we don't hear very much in Bhagavatam about previous Kali Yugas?
Why? That's a big question, actually. Why a lot of things? What the speakers say in the Bhagavatam, from my contaminated, conditioned point of view, a lot of times it seems a little bit arbitrary to me. I think, why is he talking about that? Why give so many chapters to Prithu Maharaj, for example, and so on? So you know, why they speak? It's hard to say. For some reason, they didn't. I always wonder about Ajamil, for example. I wonder when he lived a long time ago, and you think, well, what age was it when he lived? Because he was a pious Brahmin, you get the idea that it was in a Vedic times, but he was an old man at 88, so that sounds like Kali Yuga to me, right? In Dwapara Yuga, people lived to be 1,000 years old. He was only 88 years old. So maybe that was one. And Prabhupada mentions, I don't know if the verse mentions it, but in the story of Rishabhdev and his descendants, he talks about one king, it was King Arhat, right, who thought that he basically created a religion, I guess Jainism, because of Rishabhdev. And the way Prabhupada presents it, it sounds like Rishabhdev was in Kali Yuga, but that doesn't work. I don't think that doesn't seem right. But so I don't know why they don't talk about, they probably don't want to talk about it. They talk about, again, when we're talking about genealogy, you know, we're talking about these vast expanses of time and, you know, what yuga it is, in some ways it doesn't really matter. When you talk about things like, for example, the other thing is, it seems like the Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, that doesn't seem like it was Satya Yuga when they appeared. Seems like that came later when you read about the descendants, different ways. So in one sense, it's like, you know, why talk about Kali Yuga when you're talking about something, for example, that happened in a heavenly planets, which a lot of things did. The other thing I thought about in this verse is Prabhupada talks about the connections. There may be a place here that has the same name in the higher planets. Well, there was certainly a lot going on between the two places. The demigods would come down to earth, Sometimes they, of course, they would the apsaras would sometimes come down and consort with kings, and they would, you know, produce children who were half demigod and half human. And so in that context, it's sort of like what Yugad is here is in some ways more or less kind of insignificant, especially when you get above Satyaloka in those areas of the universe. Of course, we don't hear much about that. But again, when you're talking about something on a cosmic scale, Kali Yuga's, or whatever Yuga it is down here, doesn't seem to be so significant in that context. That may be one reason we don't hear about it like that. Prabhu, you had something? Oh, C to D. Dr. D.
One thing is, the Bhagavatam is about Krishna's pastimes and the Leela of the devotees, and Kali Yuga is not known for featuring that. Of course, a Kali Yuga has Lord Chaitanya appearing, and that's not an everyday event. So, could be a lot of reasons. I don't know.
There is a lot, actually. The Bhagavatam is actually spoken in reference to, in the context of the Kali Yuga. Specifically, so in that sense, it's in one sense you can say it's very focused, because it's meant for Kali Yuga, which is another thing it's hard to get my head around. I think, boy, a lot of this doesn't seem to be relatable from the perspective of Kali Yuga, all these things about sacrifices and so on. Of course, we're hearing the history, and that's all supposed to help us. We learn things. You know, I read recently. You know, when you hear about the residents of Jambudweep offering their prayers. Towards the end, it talks about how the demigods are glorifying Varsha like anything. How wonderful it is, because you can come here. And then in one place, it must be in when the four Kumaras go to the heavenly, there's a description of the heavenly planets. I think it's in the context of Tulsi Maharani being glorified by the others there for her great austerities that awarded her position as very special. So Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says, from this we can infer that even in Vaikuntha, they're attracted to Bharatvarsha because they can go higher somehow. They can become as dear to Lord Vishnu as Tulsi Devi is by coming to Bharatvarsha and performing austerities. So I read that. I said, whoa. Even in Vaikuntha, at least he presents it as a possibility that they want to come here and perform austerities so they can get more elevated somehow in Vaikuntha. That was a surprise that I read. There are many surprises in Vishwanatha Chakravarti's commentaries. Prabhu.
Yeah, thanks for a very interesting class. yeah, sometimes I think classes like this are really just to exercise brain cells.
Yeah.
And to understand that this material energy is inconceivable.
Yeah.
Srila Prabhupada mentioned the Boar Age in his purport.
Yeah.
Is that referring to the time in which Lord Varaha?
Yeah, I think he's referring, yeah. No, you know, in the story of Lord Varaha, there's a mix of two or maybe three different, I think two are mentioned. But in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, if I remember correctly, it's either four or five in this day of Brahma, appearances of Lord Varaha. But this particular, the first one is Shweta Varaha, which is, as I was saying, this is Swayambhuva Manu, the beginning of Brahma's day. So that's the white Varaha. And so he appeared at the beginning of this day. So there's a mix in the stories. That that's mentioned, Prabhupada mentions it in his purport, that there are at least two different Varaha's stories are mixed together there in the third canto. But it's called the millennium that we're in is called the Shweta Varaha day, kalpa of Brahma.
And in each of these Varaha pastimes is following the Hiranyaksha pastime of throwing the...
Well, there are details. For the first one we hear is that when he rescued the earth and he killed, I forget how the two stories go. They're mixed up there in the Bhagavatam, but they're not exactly the same. So there are details that change. When the Lord comes as different avatars, he doesn't always do exactly the same thing. Right? he's coming, why not? He can do anything he wants, so he plays on a theme, you might say. He becomes Lord Boar, but then he does what he wants to do. So he does things differently at different times.
Another question is that I hear oftentimes when there's a description of the changing of the yugas from Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwarpa Yuga, etc. But isn't it only in the age when Lord Krishna appears that otherwise it's Satya and Dwarpa, then Treta, and then Kali?
Yeah, the switching of the ages. I don't know what the definitive answer is to that. One thing, as I understand it, is that it doesn't, first of all, Prabhupada uses the word overlap. So an overlap doesn't mean one thing goes leapfrog. Usually an overlap is partly, you know, things overlap. You know, But the word actually, I think the word is it pariyaya? The way I've seen it translated, well, Bhanu Swami translates it. It means as the ages come in sequence. That's all it means. It means coming in sequence. It doesn't mean that one came before the other. That this order is always the way it is. It's always Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali. And there's a reason for these numbers, why Treta is three and Dwapara is two. But anyway, so that's one explanation. So I don't know. I mean, I've even heard a story that's supposedly from the Ramayana of how Lord Ram appeared earlier to deliver Ahalya in Treta Yuga. That's why Treta Yuga becomes before Dwapara, because he wanted Treta Yuga to come earlier so he could deliver Ahalya. But then there are a lot of versions of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and then I've asked others about it. They said, what? I never heard that story. But when ISKCON pundits said that, what? And that there's an explanation that has something to do with the numbers on the dice or something. I forget. So there are different explanations of this. So this is one that I heard, that actually there was no changing of one for the other. So I don't know. I don't have anything, like I say, definitive to say about it. All right, let's stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.